Hey guys, it's Cheekies from Cheekies and Chill. Cleaning today? Well, not exactly my idea of fun, but wait a second. Is Fabuloso involved? Because that's different. Cleaning with Fabuloso 2x concentrated cleaner turns chores into fiestas. Fabuloso pairs twice the concentrated cleaning power with long-lasting lavender freshness. From showers to countertops, floors to doorknobs, it leaves your whole home smelling and feeling like a fresh oasis. You may never love cleaning, but you will love a home cleaned with Fabuloso. So make your home dramatically clean with Fabuloso. Pick some up today at your favorite store. Fabuloso 2x concentrated formula provides 2x more active ingredients versus non-concentrated Fabuloso original. Use as directed.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife, episode 2 at the American Transplant Congress 2015 in Philadelphia. We have 3 great interviews for you today, and this podcast is going to be focused on the technical aspects of transplant surgery. We're going to hear from Dr. Dorr, again, where he's going to describe reimplanting the ureter and the different techniques involving that. What is Dr. McKenna going to talk to us about today, Joel?
Dr. McKenna is going to go through 2 particular things, one of which is the decision-making between umbilical hernias and patients with bad cirrhosis, and then secondarily, and really excitingly and very detailed, a description of a liver transplantation, which is really cool and well worth the long listen.
Our last interview is with actually the person who introduced me to transplant surgery down at Tulane University, Dr. Paramesh. He is a kidney and liver transplant surgeon, and he was my first introduction. We actually did a harvest and multiple liver transplants together, and I was fascinated ever since that day and can't get transplant out of my mind thanks to Dr. Paramesh, and he's going to talk to us about the living donor kidney transplant. And now we're going to go to the much-anticipated Dr. McKenna of Baylor University. Dr. McKenna, for the general surgery residents out there, we sometimes hear this of this situation, and it's a dreaded situation, and we're going to have you take us through it here. So you have a Hep C patient that comes into the ER. They're cirrhotic. They have tense abdominal ascites, and they present with a incarcerated umbilical hernia. Do you operate? Do you use mesh? Is there any preoperative strategies you can use to medically treat this patient?
Okay, so that's the worst case scenario you've just described there for me, and it's a no-win situation. So if you're describing a person with tense ascites, I'm imagining they're already somewhat jaundiced, and so that would be a Child-C cirrhotic right there, and probably significantly Child-C cirrhotic. Basically, taking that person to the OR carries with it a 50 to 70% mortality. Just from the anesthesia alone can decompensate the liver. And then once you've repaired the hernia won't heal because the patient's got poor liver function, and it'll start to leak ascites again through your closure, and then you'll get infected with SBP, and then the patient gets septic. Or the patient bleeds because of the significant collaterals all around the umbilicus. So it's basically a perfect storm of badness in that area. And so you only go to the OR if you absolutely have to. If there is a perforation, if there's a strangulated hernia, those are the reasons why you go. Because the mortality risk has to be greater than the 70% that you're facing just by taking them to the OR. So in these situations, you try to reduce the hernia. Okay, and you try to reduce it like you would not in a regular general surgery patient. And you sit there and squeeze and push, applying steady pressure, and you kind of move around as you go. You put a steady pressure on it with your, trying to get your fingers down to the neck, and then move it around and shift. This is not something you would do in a non-cirrhotic patient. You know, it would be wrong to do it on a non-cirrhotic patient you take them to the OR. But you can, I would estimate probably about 80 to 90% of the time reduce these hernias, even massive ones that, you know, are the size of grapefruits and, you know, small balls fitting through a hole the size of a dime. You know, if you force yourself, you can get it through. Just getting it through isn't enough, though, because after you finish that, you have to then watch the patient in hospital. They can, you know, rupture, they can perforate, they can get septic. So that patient needs to stay in hospital for a couple of days, even if they do. So that's if you can, any way, shape, or form, reduce it, then you should. If they're a child's acirrhotic, you might want to consider doing the repair if you think they're going to get worse and you may face this problem in the future. If you have to go to the OR, basically you are in and out as fast as you can. You reduce it, hope that you won't have something to resect, push it back in. You irrigate out the abdomen, okay, when you're in there. Be ready and be careful for significant bleeding that happens around the umbilicus. There's going to be collaterals there that are going to be like fire hoses when they bleed. And so be ready with big stitches that you can just tack down the inside of the abdominal wall. Don't do too much because you don't want to disturb any kind of collaterals that could start any bleeding. But you want to try to irrigate the abdomen if you can. If there's been any kind of suspected perforation or microperforation that could exist, you then would repair it with a mesh in that situation. The only time I probably wouldn't repair with a mesh if I thought we were going to the OR for a transplant very soon afterwards. But in general, almost every other time, it would be a quick repair with a mesh and get out as fast as you can. And so, sorry, the last one to remember actually is a leaking ascites. And this is, once again, another trap, because you'll get a patient who's leaking ascites through a large distended a large distended sac there. And so what you do is, with the umbilicus, rather than taking them to the OR, you can pinch it closed, kind of compressing the sac, and then put tacks of sutures down at the base, kind of squeezing it shut, if you imagine. So pulling the base of it together with little tacks that kind of turn the distended sac into like a pancake. And so I usually put three sutures that way, just through and back and through and back and through and back. And then what that does is takes the tension off the sac up top. And then you can just run like a baseball stitch over and over, back and forth. You know, usually I like to use a 3-0 nylon suture across the top of it. And then I put, some of the glue on top of the skin. And that actually is a great way to avoid going to the OR, because now the tension comes off the top of the sac and it'll heal.
So you do that in the emergency room, or?
I've done that on the floor. I've done that in the OR. I've done that in the emergency room. Usually something like this you're going to admit, but more likely than not you're called to the floor because of a patient with leaking ascites. And it's another one of those what do I do moments. You won't find that written in a textbook anywhere, but it is one I've done numerous times, and it's worked numerous times, because really what you're trying to do is buy yourself a chance to let this thing heal, and then your team can then try to decompress the ascites with a drain or a tips or something. My final suggestion for the operative repair that I forgot to mention with someone with ascites is always include a drain and keep the drain in place, because what you're trying to do after you've finished the surgery is you're trying to decompress the ascites through a controlled fashion through your drain to allow your incision to heal. I usually keep the drain in place for about, 10 to 15 days.
And is this a standard JP drain?
Standard JP drain, Blake drain with the bulb. And I don't kind of keep it on suction the entire time. I try to drain off about a liter a day.
Okay.
Basically to keep the belly from getting distended with ascites, because, what's interesting is that cirrhotic with that umbilical hernia repair has a 70% mortality rate. After my liver transplant, I will have about a 0.5% operative mortality rate. Something massive versus something tiny. And the big difference between the two is at the end of the liver transplant, I've decompressed the portal hypertension and I've got a normal functioning liver in there. Mm-hmm. And so that takes my mortality from 70 to 0.5%. So.
And are you replacing that ascites with albumin one for one or anything like that?
Usually, if you're only taking off a liter a day, you're probably pretty fine to just maintain it. That person will usually generate that ascites anyways, and they often go and get it tapped for 7 liters at a time. But at that point, I'd gauge it by the patient's fluid status. They're definitely in hospital for an extended period of time after this repair. You're not trying to rush them out.
Quickly, before we go into the last part here, could you just tell us what a typical week is for you, and how many hours would you say you put in, maybe both as a junior faculty and now that you're more of a senior faculty?
That's a loaded question. You should ask my wife and see what she says. To start with, a transplant is the greatest field of surgery. I'm going to say that right now. I love the operations. I love the connection I have with my patients. It's exciting. It's fascinating. It's fulfilling in every possible way. The lifestyle is not good, you know. And the problem is that things don't go by schedule. When I do my cases that are during the day, it's fantastic. But you will get lots of calls where there will be a donor surgery and I have to leave and fly out to El Paso in the middle of the night and get the procure the donor and bring it back to my colleague and we do the case, or, you know, vice versa, where I'll be operating all day with the liver transplant. And you never know when they're going to come, and they can just keep coming one after another after another. And so, case in point with this meeting here, I was set to fly out in the morning time, and there was a case that happened to go, and so at 10 o'clock at night I'm there, doing a transplant till about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and then getting home and racing and grabbing my stuff and running to the airport. It's a very last minute lifestyle. There will be weeks where I will put in 110 hours a week, and that's a real 110. There will be stretches where I'm working for 36 hours, 48 hours. In the current framework of medicine, that's not very attractive to people. We all want lifestyle. And to be honest with you, things are changing now as a more senior faculty, and even with our more junior faculty, where we're starting to appreciate the role of lifestyle and trying to accommodate that, accommodate our families and things. But that's what I mean when I say you're going to work a ton of hours, but it's going to come at weird times, and it's going to come without plan. That's the bad side. I make it sound like it's terrible from that, but the bonus from that is that you will be completely fulfilled with both your surgical practice, your clinical practice, and just the connection you have with your patient. There is no field of surgery, I think, that matches transplant in terms of that connection to your patient. We see our patient for 3 or 4 months afterwards. They come and they follow up every year. Last weekend was our transplant reunion picnic, and there were 1,000 patients that came back. And as my wife said, she says, I felt like I was being, married to a rock star, because I couldn't walk through the crowd without being mobbed by patients who are just excited to see you and hugging you and family members. And she stands back and looks at it with her mouth open, like she just can't see it. And the patients are all like talking to my kids who are there, and they're so thankful. And the best part of that day, actually, is that these patients come up to you that I know very, very well, but I haven't seen for 6 months to a year, and they come up to talk to me, and they're giving me a hug, and they'll be like, "Oh, Dr. McKenna," and I'll look at them, and I'll have no idea who they are, yeah. And I'll be nodding my head, being, "Oh, hey," and then suddenly, I'll see the spouse or the parent or the child, and I'll be like, "Wait, that's Mrs. Johnson. So, she hasn't changed. She looks the same. This has to be Mr. Johnson," because my patient's no longer big, distended, with ascites, emaciated, and now he looks like a completely normal person. And I can't tell you how satisfying it is to not know who your patient is when you see him. So,
but now we're going to go into, I know you wrote a book chapter about liver transplantation, and for the general surgeon out here, they're reducing our rotations on transplant more and more, and some of us will never get to see a liver transplant in residency. It's a misfortune, but if you could just briefly take us through the operative steps of this very large and time-consuming surgery.
I'm laughing because I don't seem to ever do anything briefly, but okay, so it's big. It's big surgery. I mean, liver transplant is probably the biggest surgery you can do, but it's exciting because it's all things. As an aside, what I love about it is that it's both the macro and the micro simultaneously. You're working on sewing in large vessels, the cavas, and you're trying to do it very, very quickly, as fast as you can, to get this liver in, and then all of a sudden at the very end of it, after you've reperfused and you have to stop and you have to relax, and then you have to sew in with your, you know, loops on with a 7-0, you know, suture to put together your artery. And so it's both macro and micro simultaneously. And there's not that many fields of surgery, even in vascular surgery, we have those too. But so starting off with the surgery, you position the patient supine, arms tucked in. You prep and drape the entire area from the pubis up to above the to the sternum. We make either what's called a Cheney, or a hockey stick incision for the Canadians in the group. My colleague Dr. Kim, who's also from Canada, does the same incision, or a Mercedes type incision, which is kind of a subcostal incision with a vertical extension up the midline. You enter into the abdomen, and you have to be careful because there's going to be significant collaterals on the way in that bleed that don't happen in regular cases because these patients are with portal hypertension. So you got to be prepared. Even just entering in, the thing you do a million times a day in any other case, is going to have some significant bleeding. First off, we get in, we take a sample of the ascites so that we know what their infection is like as a baseline that gets sent off. We take down the falciform ligament with 2-0 silk sutures, dividing it, and that thing can often be hugely distended, like the size of a small aorta, because it's just full of portal hypertensive congested blood. But we tie that off and take down the rest of the falciform ligament up to the level of the hepatic veins. I put in my retractor, which is usually a Thompson retractor, which two of them with an upper arm and a lower arm, and I put in the blades to retract the upper part. Then I take a lap pad, put it behind the spleen, and mobilize my left triangular ligament with the electrocautery. I lift it up, and then I divide the gastrohepatic ligament, which is the layer that's connected between the liver and the stomach. What's important in that section is a replaced hepatic artery. A left replaced hepatic artery can be traveling through there, so you need to be both aware that it's there and that so that you can tie it off. But also sometimes you need that artery as an inflow, so you got to preserve it. There's also can be huge amounts of collaterals in there. So if there are significant collaterals in that ligament, I often use ligature to go up it. But if not.
Can I ask you a quick question? Hearing about all this bleeding that can occur.
There's not that much bleeding in the case, but yes.
But potentially can occur. What do you have anesthesia? What product do you have in the room before you go into one of these cases?
Well, so the connection we have with our anesthesiologists is a very tight one. We were in constant communication with it. At Baylor, we have fabulous anesthesiologists there. We're extremely lucky. At our program. So the anesthesiologist will typically not necessarily have the blood in the room, but they'll have the blood in the banks. They usually set them up with 4 to 6 units of FFP and blood ready to go outside in the fridge if needed. They'll have a cell saver in place for most cases, and the cell saver is used to collect the blood, filter it down, and give it back. And so the cell saver is hugely important for the surgery because it helps minimize your transfusion requirements. But that's a very good question. And if there it does start to get bleeding, there's a communication that takes place between the anesthesiologist, and we will often say and put our head over and say, there's significant collaterals. I expect some bleeding here, and that the anesthesia becomes aware of it. They make all the difference in whether the case goes super smooth or not. Back to the surgery, we mobilize the right triangular ligament with electrocautery just enough so I can bring the liver forward. And then the next part was we focus on the hilum. We put in our retractor blades on the lower part of the abdomen retract the stomach and the intestines down, and that exposes the hilum of the liver. And so then the goals of the hilum of the liver is you want to tie off both branches of the hepatic artery, but sometimes there's more branches, but essentially both branches of the hepatic artery, left and right, between 2-0 silk ligatures. Then that's usually going to come on the left side of the hilum. And then on the right side of the hilum, you're going to find your bile duct. I typically divide, if I can, the cystic duct and the bile duct independently. so that it allows me to get higher up on my bile duct and tie it all high. And in these things, you are trying to tie them up higher towards the liver so that you have longer stumps for later.
So just below the bifurcation?
So for the artery, I'm tying them above the bifurcation. I'll go take a left out and a right. That usually bifurcates lower. For the bile duct, it's usually going to be below the bifurcation because the bifurcation is going to be high up near the plate. But I try to get above the cystic, so we'll take out the cystic and then go higher. I basically say that, this is what was done, but sometimes that can be very precarious because it's tons of collaterals in that area, and you have to do it very, very slowly. In a portal hypertensive patient, vessels that are the size of hairs are now the size of like small pencils because they're filled with blood, and they're very, very delicate. So, you have to tie things off or use a ligature, a lot of electrocautery. Then we expose the portal vein, and once those two things are tied off, it becomes easier to strip the tissue away from the portal vein until I can expose it all the way up to the hilum. Hopefully there's not a thrombus in the portal vein. If there is a thrombus in the portal vein, it's going to need to be removed at the time of the resection of the liver. So at this point, the decision's made as to what type of transplant I'm going to do. Either I need to do what's called a cavo replacement, where I'm going to take the liver out, cutting out the cavo with the liver, or I'm going to do a piggyback style liver where I'm basically going to resect the liver off and leave the cavo in place. So if I were to do a cavo replacement type liver, I'm going to mobilize the rest of my right lobe, carry my dissection down onto the vena cava with electrocautery, take it along the right side of the vena cava, tying off the adrenal vein between two osteochondral ligatures, and in that situation, the adrenal vein can be a real pain, and if the adrenal starts to bleed, it basically will bleed for the rest of the case. So you try not to let that happen, and I carry the dissection up towards the top of the vena cava towards the hepatic veins. I then flip over the liver to the other side and do the exact same maneuver along the left side of the vena cava all the way up to the top. It's easier because there isn't an adrenal vein at this point. You then try to divide the tissue behind the vena cava. And so really that just becomes dissecting as you kind of rotate it over, getting under it, until you can see to the other side. And once you can see to the other side, you can push your finger underneath the vena cava and just dissect on your finger. And you take your dissection all the way up to the top, so right up at the level of the hepatic veins and above them. And then you take the lower dissection all the way down to the vena cava just above the renal veins. You try not to see the renal veins, but you kind of know where they are. And so now you can basically get your clamp through on both sides. So once I'm ready there, then I divide I go back to the hilum, I divide my portal vein. And actually before we divide the portal vein, you do what's called a test clamp, because I want to know to my anesthesiologist that they're filled up with blood and are they ready. And so you communicate with your anesthesiologist and you'll put a clamp on your vena cava, you put a clamp on your portal vein, and you sit and you wait. And you ask the anesthesiologist, and you watch the pressure. And if everybody's all happy with the stability of the patient, then you go ahead. And if not, if they need more blood, then you wait and see, or volume. Then often they'll put them on pressors. Because the thing is, once you start cutting that cava, you're going to be 40 minutes with the clamps on. Mm-hmm. So there's no going back once you've cut it. So you got to be ready. And so assuming that everything's good, I'll put my clamp on the lower cava, called an ascending clamp, which is kind of an angled Debakey clamp on the lower vena cava. I'll put either a Satinsky or what we call a Clint Mom clamp, named after my boss at my program, on the upper cava. And we've already divided our portal vein, and we remove the liver. And then basically we cut just above the vena cava into the hepatic veins on the top, and then you cut way, way high along the vena cava at the bottom. And really what you're doing is trying to leave yourself long stumps on both, because you don't know really what's the liver, how it's going to fit. And then you take your liver out, you stop as much bleeding as you can, but you got to remember now you're going to have tons of portal hypertension again because you totally clamped that portal vein. And all the bleeding that you'd managed to stop will start to ooze again. So the new livers, before you get the new liver on the field, you turn the upper cava into a common cuff, because you usually have three veins. You divide the bridges between the three veins, you make a common cuff. And then on the bottom one, you kind of fix your little holes from your short hepatics that you've had on your lower cava. And you kind of shorten that one to kind of match the size. You bring your liver on the field that has been prepared on the back table by your friend or your, you know, the fellow, or by you if you know, depending on how the case has gone beforehand. It's brought on out of the ice into the field. And then you start first with the upper vena cava. And so I use a 4-0 proline. And you sew the back wall first and then the front wall in a running fashion. And really, basically, you kind of get through, you know, with the suture on the recipient side, and then you bring it. And now you're inside, so you go from outside in, and then you take your stitch and you start sewing the back wall of the donor to the back wall of the recipient all along, and then you kind of bring one stitch out, and then you take the other branch of the stitch and sew the top wall of the vena cava, and you're kind of everting the edges so that it's endothelium to endothelium as you're kind of running along the top part, and you're trying to do that as fast as you can. Hopefully you can do it in about 10-12 minutes
per each anastomosis.
The goal would be to be about 10-12 minutes per anastomosis. Often the upper one is tough, and if this is our large obese NASH patient we were talking about, this is one where it can get really tough because everything is tight in there. There's tons of bowel pushing up. You're working in a big space. The person's going to be very deep. And so you're a long way away with long instruments, trying to sew in this anastomosis from a distance at speed, And there's, maybe a little bit of oozing and bleeding going, and they're trying to suck it. And sometimes every stitch can be a quest. You just get the one stitch, and you just see it, and then you have to get the other stitch. So it can be fun.
So you have the three hepatic veins that you are making into a common.
Yeah, so the three hepatic veins will come into the vena cava. We cut up higher to make it so it's more of a. So you'll have a cava and the three veins, and you basically just cut the bridge between them, and now you have one big orifice to sew to. It's important to make sure you have excellent outflow of your liver. If you have an obstruction or even a narrowing of the veins, that'll basically end the case in the ICU afterwards. So it has to have good outflow.
So there's one outflow anastomosis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's one outflow on the donor, we are sewing in the vena cava of the donor. So the hepatic veins in the donor will go into the vena cava at the top, the suprahepatic vena cava, and then we'll sew that into the recipient's vena cava. And so you're basically just trying to take the cava of the donor liver and attach the suprahepatic vena cava to the suprahepatic vena cava of the recipient. And then we'll do the exact same thing on the infrahepatic vena cava of the donor to the recipient. And so the technique of the infrahepatic one is exactly the same. You put in your stitches and you evert them backwards, and it's inside out, back wall, front wall, the same way I kind of described it on the upper cava. The only interesting element of it is that you have to flush the portal vein while you're doing this. And so this is to get all of the potassium and all the preservation solution out of the liver. So you're flushing the liver with this, and you run it through a tubing through the portal vein, but of course all the fluid comes out of the vena cava while you're sewing it. So you're trying to sew basically a hose while the hose is on, and so you have to kind of just stitch it, but you don't really get to see it well because, IV fluid and this iced solution is flushing the stuff out of the lower cava. So, and once again, there's time, you can't sit there and wait and do this, slowly. You have to whip it in as fast as you can. And like I said, it's a macro, suturing, but you're trying to do it fast. And so you do the back wall and the front wall. And the last part you do is the portal vein, and you shorten that down. It becomes very important to make sure there's no redundancy of the portal. And so you take your portal vein and you clamp it maybe about a centimeter and a half, 2 centimeters above the, or cut it about a centimeter, 2 centimeters above the clamp. And then you shorten your donor portal vein to the appropriate length. And then you anastomose it end to end again, exact same fashion, everting the edges using 6-0 prolines. And so it's much smaller. the most important part of it at the end is that you need to put in what's called a growth factor. And so it's a big air knot that's about a centimeter, you know, long at the end of the case, and or at the end of the anastomosis. So you don't singe it down and tie it. You tie the knot about a centimeter up from the vein. You know, on purpose, you're putting in an air knot, the kind of air knot that, you know, your attending would yell at you for, if, you know, when you were a resident for doing. This is the one time where you want to do it. And the reason for that is that that vein will expand.
Once it gets
the blood flowing through there, and so you have to account for that. If you don't, there will be a portal vein, you know, thrombosis, and the patient will die from it afterwards. So, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, what they had to do before they learned that's what, you know, in the 60s, right, that's what would happen. You know, that's how they figured this stuff out, is, oh, patient died from a, you know, or the dog died from a portal vein thrombosis. We've got to come up with a way to prevent that. You know, this is exactly the way Starzl did it, you know, 45, you know, almost 50 years ago. So, and so the next, next thing after that is you reperfuse the liver, and you've got to do this generally slowly. You once again, you're talking with your anesthesiologist, letting them know. You try to find out, if you can, what the potassium level is. You look up at the temperature of the patient, and you guide yourself and the patient. Because if you just go bang, bang, take off your clamps, this huge potassium level flows through. All the acid and buildup from the intestine goes into the liver, and then the first place it hits is the heart. And the potassium level goes from the 4.5 that it was up to 7 and or 8, and then the patient arrests on you. And you can easily put the patient into asystole when you take the clamps off. And it becomes the riskiest part of the case, because anybody, even the healthy people, their hearts can stop in this case. And just the cold, you know, and you can watch it, and you'll see on the monitor the T waves start to peak up. And if it's getting kind of bad, the QRS complex will widen, and then your own QRS complex starts to widen. You know, but you do it slowly. You remove your upper clamp, you remove your lower clamp, you make sure there's no bleeding on your cava. And then usually things stabilize, because now your anesthesiologist has blood from the legs and has the caval blood, and so their preload increases, and so you'll actually see them get more stable. But then you still haven't released your liver clamp with your portal vein, so you take your clamp off, and we do it slowly, you know, watching the temperature to make sure it doesn't plummet down, because they'll go from a 36, 37 down to a 31, 32. You know, and when your temperature goes down that low,
solution?
Well, it's an iced, the liver is iced, you know,
right.
And it's so all that iced fluid is now hitting the heart, you know, and so, it, you know, sure, if it went through the rest of the body, it would warm up, but everything hits the heart first. And so, you know, that, because remember, you're basically sewing the liver into the base of the heart.
Right.
And so then you take off your clamps, and assuming everything just goes normally, which it should do 98% of the time, you know, you now kind of pack things off, and your liver's, you know, your liver's now getting blood, but what you have to remember is that your bile ducts are not. And so your liver is now warming up, but your bile ducts do not have a blood flow to them, because they need the arteries, so you're getting warm ischemia into your bile ducts. So you quickly kind of pack things off. If there's major bleeding from the cava or something, you put some stitches in. Otherwise, you know, you just put packs in, come back to them later. And then you figure out how you're going to put your artery in. Sometimes you have to reconstruct things to replace the arteries, lefts and rights. You have to figure out how you're going to do it. I usually sew the proper hepatic of my recipient into the proper hepatic, if I can, of the donor. I will, you know, place a Dartic clamp on the artery, and we've already dissected off that artery usually beforehand just to get it out. And then shorten the artery with tenotomy scissors, cut the artery, and then anastomose it with a parachute technique with a 7-0 proline under magnification with loops. And that's what I mean. You know, the previous one I've been using long instruments for on my, you know, my obese patient from a distance, yeah, fast as I can. Now I'm up close, you know, and trying to get the hands slowed down from shaking, you know, so... So we anastomose it end-to-end with a 7-0, a parachute technique, and pull it in. And you try and you then take off your clamp and reperfuse your artery, and you wait till the artery dilates up, and then you kind of tie your knot. So you kind of pull it down, take your clamps off, let everything expand. Similar concept. You don't want a narrowing there. And then you tie it down, making sure you don't break your 7-0, because, you know, it's like, you know, now your hands are all, you know, sticky with everything there. So So now your artery's got reperfusion, and things should be starting to stabilize out with your, because once the body gets a liver that's functioning back, and the liver's usually functioning right away, you'll see the patient just get much more stable. And then the next comes the bile duct. You shorten them to the appropriate length. You want to make sure your donor bile duct is as short as possible because the blood supply is most compromised. And then you anastomose your portal vein, or sorry, your bile duct of your recipient to the bile duct of your artery using, I use a running 6-0 PDS suture. A lot of people use interrupted 6-0 prolines. The difficulty is trying to make the plumbing match because they're often, you know, one is about 4 or 5 millimeters in size and one of them is, you know, 12 or 13 millimeters in size, and you have to make them match, you know, which can be a real pain. And then at that point in time, your case is basically done. It's a matter of stopping the bleeding, and that can be, if this liver is working perfectly, it's nice and easy. Right. If the liver is slow to function, you can end up getting a coagulopathy, and that gets a continued ongoing oozing and lysis that continues, and you know, sometimes you can spend hours just trying to pack things and stop bleeding and pack if that liver is not working right away.
And do you leave drains at your bile duct?
Don't leave any drains at all in the abdomen. Basically, we make sure it's dry when we're in there. You know, look at the bile duct to make sure there's no leak. I usually use a little sponge that I push around it to demonstrate. Okay. If I'm concerned, I put in more stitches, and if I don't like the bile duct, I do it again. The bile duct is the nemesis and the problem with the whole, they call it the Achilles heel of the liver transplant, and you got to make sure it's good, and if you're not happy with it, you redo it.
Right.
And then, you know, you stop your bleeding, and you know, our final technique is we get a biopsy of the liver to make sure that we have what's called a perfusion biopsy and know what our baseline is. We put a feeding tube into the duodenum, you know, and I feed it in by hand because particularly if our patient's very sick and malnourished and could be in the ICU for a while if they were intubated beforehand, like the case that you had there. We want to make sure they're getting maximal nutrition because that A, you know, helps immunomodulate them, B, it helps prevent infections, and C, it gets them nutrition in them to start healing. And then I close the abdomen with running number one proline suture and skin clips, and then go to the ICU.
That was fantastic.
Then I call my wife and say, sorry, babe, I didn't mean to be an hour and a half late getting home. Clinically, you will not find a field more satisfying than this, both from a surgical point of view, like, it, you know, we're all surgeons, we all like to operate. This is so filling and so thrilling from that point of view. And if you're a clinician or physician and like to manage sick patients and be cerebral, you'll get that in this field. And if you want to just, you know, hook up with your patients, you know, in terms of with your the connecting with them and their family and being involved in their lives and being sort of fulfilled and knowing that you've changed someone's life, then this will do it to you. And the thing about transplant is, well, there's lots of small operations in transplant, but every transplant you do is changes or saves someone's life. There is no sort of small little case in the field. And so it's awesome from that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the lifestyle thing will work itself out in the future.
All right. Thank you, Dr. McKenna. And now, like I said before, this is Dr. Paramesh of Tulane University. He's a transplant surgeon, and he's going to take us through the living donor kidney transplant. With no further ado, here's Dr. Paramesh.
Thank you for being here on Behind the Knife.
Thank you for having me. So proud you're doing this.
We just want to talk a little bit about the living donor kidney transplant, as that's the program you run. What when you're evaluating a patient and a family and discussing with this family, what considerations and counseling do you have with this family about having a living donor transplant?
You're talking medical considerations or in general?
In general.
So obviously doing a living donor surgery is quite different from other surgeries. I mean, here you have a completely healthy person that doesn't need a surgery, but they're doing this only because they want to help somebody else. So just the concept behind it itself is true nobility. But obviously there's room for these processes to get corrupted. There's always a chance of being of coercion versus somebody getting paid to do this. So that's always an issue that we need to rule out. So the criteria for selecting somebody to be a living donor are pretty strict across the country, and most transplant centers follow the same guidelines, I would say. Most of the guidelines are established by what we call the Amsterdam criteria. There was an international consensus conference held about a decade ago, and most people agreed in what they thought would be appropriate versus not. And that includes both medical as well as psychosocial criteria. So everybody that gets evaluated for a living donor has to undergo very strict medical criteria to make sure that, that this is safe for them and they don't have any pre-existing conditions that could potentially hurt them in the future. Then after that, they all usually get a psychological evaluation to make sure that they're competent to make this decision. They have to be an adult, by the way. A child is not allowed to do this. And that they understand actually what they're getting themselves into, and this is not going to hurt them anyway, even from a psychological or social standpoint, like losing their job or losing money with their job, things like that. They do get financial counseling, and the law also actually states they have to see a dietitian as well, too, to kind of make sure that they know to stay on a healthy diet and live a healthy life afterwards, because now they're just going to have one kidney protecting them. But the point being is that a healthy person should not need two kidneys. It's our job to counsel them to make sure that they understand that they need to stay healthy for the rest of their life, and this is not for the reason of the donor, it's for themselves.
Right. And so now we just want to go into, we've been doing some of the technical aspects of the procedures. If you can just take us through the day of the harvest and the transplant and kind of how it's slightly different than obviously a deceased procedure.
Sure. So most of these are elective procedures, as you probably figured out. And for those of you that know something about transplant, you know the most important test that has to be done before a transplant is a cross-match. That actually was on your app site, so you probably won't remember that. But in any case, so with a deceased donor transplant, we usually do the cross-match immediately before and go straight to surgery. But with a living donor, we have the luxury of time. So typically, we do the cross-match usually a day or two before. We're allowed to do it within 48 hours of the transplant procedure itself. So most of them come in the day before surgery to the clinic. We do their H&P. They get the final cross-match done, and they get the final counseling. And they come into morning. They come in for admission the next morning as day of surgery admission. Typically, the donor surgery starts first. The recipient is the donor is taken into the room. We position them, and then start the procedure. The procedure goes in for a little bit, and if everything is going smoothly and everything looks the way it's supposed to, the donor team will typically call the recipient team to go into an adjoining room, and the recipient is wheeled into the next room. And they start the case there. And once both the teams are ready, meaning that the recipient room is open and ready to implant the kidney, we snip the kidney, take it out, flush out all of the blood, and head it over to the recipient room.
Now, which kidney is this normally?
So pretty much most people would prefer to take the left kidney, and in about most studies will say between 85 to 95% of the time it's the left kidney that's removed, and that's because the left kidney has longer renal vein, so it makes it easier to take out as well as implant it in.
And can you talk to us a little bit how you approach that when you're doing the donor operation?
Approach meaning the surgical technique itself?
Surgical technique, yeah.
So pretty much most of the time it's done laparoscopically or hand-assisted laparoscopically. There are some cases where it's being done robotically now, but the approach is still the same. You take down the splenic flexure of the colon, the peritoneal attachments of the left colon and rotate it downwards and medially. You open up the gyrotis fascia and dissect the kidney, expose the kidney underneath that. Then you dissect in the hilum, and the difference between a nephrectomy that a urologist would do as opposed to us is we stay as far away from the hilum as we can because we want to preserve the length of the vessels. So typically we're doing if it's for a left kidney, I'm doing my dissection near the aorta so that I can get the vein and the artery at this point here. There will be branches of the left vein there that you're going to have to watch out for. There's an adrenal branch. There's a gonadal branch, both of which will need to be ligated so that the kidney can come out safely. Sometimes there's a lumbar vessel as well that goes posteriorly, so you're going to have to identify that so you don't have a problem. So once you've freed up all of those vessels and you've identified the ureter all the way down to the pelvis, we'll call the recipient room to make sure they're ready for the kidney, and then we'll staple across the vessels, artery first, then vein, and then the ureter is divided at the same time, and then the kidney is removed from the operative field, taken to a back table where we divide the staple lines, flush out all of the blood with preservative solution, and then transfer the kidney over.
I guess just one thing came to my head. You don't lose any extra length by stapling versus a clamp and a cut?
You're right. That is obviously a point of contention. Most of the staples that we have or that we feel comfortable with are three rows of staples, and if there's going to be three rows of staples either side, that's six rows of staples. So typically you're losing about a centimeter with most normal staplers. So there are a couple of new staplers that are out there that people are using that have only two rows of staples, and maybe that'll give us an extra length. Now, this is a high risk operation if donors can't afford to have complications. So there are complications that have occurred when people have used clips or something thinner to kind of divide the blood vessel. And it's still being done in some places, but many people do find that risky, and they're just comfortable going with what's safest on the market. So yes, but that is an issue.
Great. And then, so as this whole thing happened, the patient, the recipient is being opened, mm-hmm. And how far are they getting that operation? How much of an overlap is there?
Well, an ideal case scenario, they've already opened up the pelvis, the iliac fossa. We make what's called a Gibson incision, G-I-B-S-O-N. You expose the external iliac artery and vein through retroperitoneal exposure. So ideally, the iliac vessels are already exposed and everything is retracted and they're ready to clamp and put a kidney in.
Great. And can you tell us about the vessels and how you attach the vessels?
Most people anastomose the kidneys to the external iliac artery and vein. We put clamps across. We do the vein first because the vein is deeper. And truthfully, the right side is easier to put on because the iliac vessels on the right side are more horizontal, run more horizontally as opposed to the left side where they run deep. But different programs have different protocols as far as the way they put it in. In my program, we tend to put left kidneys on the left and right kidneys on the right. So that may be an issue that an institution might have. But no matter what, the vein is deeper. So we typically do the venous anastomosis first because it's deeper. Then we progress more superficially to the artery. Now, if the donor kidney has multiple vessels, which about 20 to 30% of the population do, so there may be some reconstruction of the vessels that might need to occur to implant those vessels. Typically, we try to get both those vessels on a single cuff to anastomose, but in certain instances, they might have to do two separate anastomoses. There are some people that even anastomose one of the branches to the inferior epigastric vessel, which is coming off the external iliac as well, too. So that's another option that's sometimes there. And there are even certain centers that like to use the internal iliac. They dissect the internal iliac vessel all the way down to the pelvis and flip it upwards and use that as the anastomosis. So there are different ways of putting it in, but, you know, whatever you're trained in, whatever you worked in is what will work for you.
And when you're doing these anastomoses, is it generally a parachute or...?
I've seen it done both ways. I don't parachute it down. I tend to put the stay switches and run it quickly. And you know, most people are trying to get the point of doing a parachuting down is that you might be able to keep the kidney in the ice slush a little longer while you're trying to parachute, while you're getting multiple stitches through it. Whereas if you just tie it down, the kidney has to be theoretically out of ice and you've started your ischemic time.
I see.
So the point is, as long as you can sew the kidney in, typically in 30 to 40 minutes, there's not that much difference between them, I don't think.
And are you leaving the clamps on until both anastomoses are done? So,
typically, yes.
Okay. And so you go in, you made the dissection, you've plugged in your vein and your artery,
mm-hmm.
and then do you release the clamps before you go to the ureter?
Yes, you do. You release the clamps before the ureters. We open the venous anastomosis first because that's the deeper one, and if there's any bleeding, you can see it.
I see.
They make sure that's not bleeding. Then you release the clamps, the distal one first before the proximal one, and we actually put a clamp across the renal artery itself to prevent any clots from going into the renal artery. We'd rather flush it down the leg.
Mm.
So distal clamp first, proximal clamp while clamping the artery, and if everything looks good, then open up the artery and it tends to work well.
And then you take the ureter?
That is correct. So then we take the ureter and then we do the urethral anastomosis, and there's a couple of ways of doing it. Most places anastomose it directly to the bladder. The bladder is usually insufflated with some antibiotic solution, so you can feel it. You'll be surprised sometimes in a renal failure patient that has not made urine for many years, it's actually quite difficult to find the bladder sometimes because their bladders are so small, and it's a known complication is actually sewing the ureter into the sigmoid colon, which sits right there thinking that that's a bladder. So that has happened, and it's a well-known complication. The other people have anastomosed to the ureter of the native kidney. The reason they do that is because the native ureter already has a nice anti-reflux mechanism and stuff, so it tends to work better from that perspective. So I've seen it done both ways, and both of them work.
And what kind of suture are you using when you're sewing this in?
So you've got to use a absorbable suture, obviously, because if you use a non-absorbable, you're increasing the risk for stones to form in the bladder. So typically, PDS is what I use. I've seen some other people use Maxon sutures.
Okay. When you did the donor operation, how much length of ureter are you taking?
The more, the better, obviously, but it's never going to be as long as a deceased donor one. So the average length that most people get when they take out a living donor kidney is about 10 to 12 centimeters.
Okay. And is there anything you do to maintain, because I imagine if the kidney got kinked in a certain position, it could be catastrophic. Is there anything you do in the pelvis to secure the kidney in place, or does it generally stay in the correct orientation?
Well, it generally stays, but one of the risks, that is a risk for a living donor kidney, and I'm glad you brought that up. So obviously the length of the vessels are much shorter in a renal, in a living donor as opposed to a deceased donor. So understand that the vein is deeper and the kidney typically lies laterally, which means that the vein has to fold over the external iliac artery. And sometimes that external iliac artery can compress that vein. So if we think it's going to be an issue, sometimes people will flip the kidney over medially, so it's actually lying on top of the bladder as opposed to laterally. So that's one of the tricks we sometimes use. But everybody's got a very low threshold for imaging these people. As like I said, a living donor kidney is a high profile operation. Right. So many places will get an ultrasound, will close the abdomen and make sure everything looks good while they're closing, maybe even get an ultrasound while they're still in the operating room to make sure there's good blood flow once you close the belly. So that these are things that a lot of people do because it's a high-stakes operation.
So Dr. Paramesh, one last question is, when you are getting the cadaveric specimens, they generally have cuffs of the vena cava and aorta on them. How much vessel are you getting when you have those come in?
Sure. So the protocol that's pretty much followed by throughout the country is the artery has to come with a cuff of the aorta. If there are multiple arteries, typically we'd like them all on a common cuff if possible. The renal vein, the left kidney will come with the renal vein with a little cuff of the vena cava. The right kidney is supposed to come with the full vena cava. That's because the right renal vein is so short. So typically what we do is we reconstruct the right renal vein by extending, like oversewing the upper and lower portions of the vena cava to lengthen the right renal vein. So that's the protocol, that the right kidney always has to come with the full vena cava.
And now if you're transplanting a right kidney from a living donor, are there any tricks for extending that vein length?
So typically you're going to have the, it's a short vein as we know that, so people will try to dissect the vena cava a little bit so we can put a clamp a little bit on the vena cava itself as opposed to on the vein, so to give a little bit extra length. But a right living donor surgery is a lot more difficult than the left because the vein is so short.
Thank you, Dr. Paramesh. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin.
And thank you, Dr. Paramesh, for taking us through the living donor kidney transplant. And please tell all my old Tulane colleagues I say hi, and go Green Wave. And to finish out the podcast this week, we have Dr. Frank Dorr of Rotterdam, Netherlands at Erasmus University. He was on the first podcast, and today he'll be telling us some of the technical details of how to deal with that difficult kidney transplant and how to re-implant the ureter. Fortunately, most of the time, I am able to edit out my knowledge deficits. But in this episode, I was not exactly up to date on my ureter reimplantation methods, and it comes across. But I imagine there are a few other residents out there that don't know all the techniques to reimplant a ureter, so hopefully there'll be some learning from this.
I was hoping we could just bring one tough clinical scenario and kind of hear your perspective on it. We were just talking with Dr. Paramesh on living donor transplants. And how about that patient that you're taking out the right kidney and you have a short renal vein? What techniques or tricks do you have to make that anastomosis work?
Yeah, so we don't have a strong preference for left or right, to be honest with you. If you look at the anatomy of the renal vein on the right side, it's often much thinner. And of course, because of the location close to the caval vein, it's generally shorter than the left-sided vein. I think the trick is the Benz surgery. So if you have a right kidney, you really have to cut down on the renal vein and elaborate a little bit on it just to get more length by, you know, freeing it up from the artery and other structures like fatty tissues. Then really you can stretch it out a little bit further. To be honest with you, I have seen a few problems, but it's never been a reason to not pick a right kidney. Unless we have a very difficult recipient. If the recipient is, for example, super obese and or has had multiple transplants, then you may need a longer length of the vein. And therefore, if you have the choice, pick the left kidney. But the trick is really meticulous bench working and, of course, anastomosis techniques. We implant the kidney in situ. And a lot of people in different centers do a sort of parachuting technique outside of the body. And then, of course, you may stretch a little bit more on the vein and you can probably tear the vein more easily. So I think if you do an in-situ end-to-side anastomosis with running sutures, we only use one suture and we go all the way around. Very easy.
It's always
proline, 5-0 for the vein, 6-0 for the artery. Always the same. We do the same for the caval anastomosis in liver transplantation. Always the same. That works really well.
And then how do you anastomose the ureter?
So we prefer the extravesical anastomosis.
Oh, really?
We changed that actually after we finished a trial comparing intravesical versus extravesical. And during the trial, we were all trained to do an intravesical anastomosis. But during the trial, everyone felt more comfortable using the extravesical. And this is what we all do now. So it's really interesting how a clinical trial can change your practice, even without finding significant differences between either of the two techniques.
So what was it about the trial that made you guys change?
It's more easy. And because if you do an intravesical anastomosis, you have to cut down on the bladder. You have to open the bladder to a significant extent. So I think you get more hematuria. And of course, you have to tunnel the ureter, make a hole in the bladder, and then invert it inside. And it's a little bit more cumbersome. Of course, it's still a nice technique, but it's a little faster to do it extravesical.
The extravesical versus intravesical anastomosis. What exactly does that mean? I'm a little confused.
Okay, so it's very easy. The extravesical anastomosis, you have the bladder in front of you.
Right.
You just make a tiny little hole in the bladder after having filled the bladder with warm saline, just to get a nice balloon there. So you open the detrusor muscle and then the mucosa. So it opens up nicely for you.
Okay.
And then you just take the ureter. We cleave it always a little bit like a cobra.
Uh-huh.
It's well known from vascular surgery, I guess. And we just make an anastomosis mucosa with a few bites on the detrusor. And then we take two detrusor stitches to create an entry reflux mechanism. So that's the extravesical. The intravesical is, you have the same balloon of bladder there. You cut the bladder open and then make a hole on the side of the bladder. Tunnel the ureter through that hole, then do the cobra. The cobra cut, and then anastomose it on the inside of the bladder. So the extravesical is on the outside, and the intravesical is really on the inside of the bladder. And we normally use interrupted stitches for that.
Okay.
So that's the difference, and then you have to close the bladder itself, and the whole thing is done.
Okay. I was totally, when you said extravesical, I went straight to the ureterostomy. And that's why I was confused. I apologize for that.
No problem.
And just for my education, what percent would you say in the U.S. is intravesical versus extravesical?
I have no idea. I think most people in the world use the extravesical anastomosis.
Okay.
But I would love to learn.
Maybe it's a study we can look into doing here.
Small survey.
On Twitter. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Dorr, once again. That was just fantastic.
I just wanted to take a second to thank the American Transplant Congress staff, especially Caitlin, their social media editor. She was extremely helpful in finding us these interviews and finding us a quiet space to do these interviews. So thank you, Caitlin. Thank you, American Transplant Congress, for your help. And just a reminder, follow at @Frank_Dorr to hear a little bit about European transplant and other things. And then, of course, at Joel Adler and at Behind the Knife. All of these are on Twitter. And we just have one exciting piece of news. We hit 10,000 downloads in just 2 months of being on the air. So we really thank you guys for that. One thing that you guys could do that'd be really helpful for us is to get on iTunes and give us some stars and give us some reviews. We have 9 reviews total out of our 10,000 downloads, and I'm pretty sure a majority of those are my parents and other family members. So if you guys can get on there, it really helps us out and helps us bump us up the iTunes charts. And, you know, we've actually had a few residents and staff email us in some people they wanted to hear and some topics they wanted to get. So we're definitely going to get those on air. Christopher Graham of Boston University emailed us saying he'd like to hear a little bit more about the thyroid and the parathyroid. Not only that, but he also talked to their chief of surgery at Boston University, Dr. Doherty, and Dr. Doherty agreed to do it. So you'll be hearing soon on Behind the Knife, Dr. Doherty talking about thyroid disease. The ironic thing about this is I had just gotten off a phone interview with Dr. Chin of University of Wisconsin about parathyroid disease. So you'll be hearing that soon, too. So we have a broad range of subjects coming up. We have everything from the thyroid and parathyroids to breast cancer to pancreatitis and to critical care. Keep tuned. We have a lot of stuff coming your way.
All right. That wraps it up for us, guys. Episode 1 and Episode 2 at the American Transplant Congress. We hope you guys enjoyed this. And we hope to get Behind the Knife at more and more conferences. We're planning on being at the Colorectal Conference and at the ACS. And we'd love to get you guys involved in helping us interview. And whatever we can do to get more people involved Behind the Knife, we'd be really excited. We've had such a great experience working with Joel Adler of Mass General, who really was the driving force behind getting us all these connections at the American Transplant Congress. And we both just learned so much. So thank you, Joel, again for joining.
Well, of course, Kevin, anytime. I think you're doing some really, really great work. I'm glad that I was able to contribute in some way.
And that's it for us. Thanks, guys.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.